So, Bob, a few weeks ago, I sent a survey to everyone asking for questions for you. So, let's read those questions and respond.
Yeah.
Anonymous patron says, "Hi, Bob and Kirk. I have a colleague, let's call him Jim, who seems to be a notorious victim blamer. He knows not to ask questions like, what was she wearing? But he does ask, in what part of the city was she in? Another coworker got into a bad breakup. It turned out her boyfriend had been taking financial advantage of her. Of course, Jim's number one topic was how she is bad at selecting boyfriends and should have seen this coming. Thankfully, he never tells this to anyone's face. He has the same response when we discuss stories from the media. In most of these instances, I tell him that he is blaming the wrong person. I haven't been able to change his mind one bit. Do you think people do this so they can feel safe themselves? Like, if I'm smart enough, bad things won't happen to me? Or are there other reasons?" So just chime in here, Bob, what do you think?
That's an interesting theory. I think there's a good shot of it. The other thought I had was perhaps maybe they feel responsible and somehow they offload responsibility by blaming the person, the wrong person. I don't know. It's all speculation. Boy, how annoying that would be.
Yeah. I find it's common that people do this, don't
yeah.
you?
Yeah. Yeah, they do. All too common.
Yeah. And I think I could at least think thoughts like this. Like if I heard about someone's car being broken into or them being mugged, I imagine that I would have at least a flash question of, well, what part of town were they in, right? And, you know, it is a factor, I suppose, but it's if that's all that you think, and if it's particularly what you communicate to other people, it creates this culture of victim blaming. Yeah. And there are certain victim blaming topics that we've educated the public, like Jim knows not to say if she were raped or something, what was she wearing?
Yeah.
He knows not to say that because we've educated people on that specific victim blaming aspect, but that doesn't catch all the different aspects of victim blaming.
Yeah.
And yeah, I will find it hard sometimes to communicate with people in situations like this because it's like, but we all understand that for someone to wrong another person, the person who committed the transgression is the wrong one. And yeah, maybe like with the coworker who had a bad breakup and the boyfriend took a financial advantage of her. Yeah, you could perhaps, if you took all the factors into consideration, made a bullet point list, maybe one of the factors was that she might have been a little gullible or a little non-scrutinizing of the requests or the demands or the pressures that he was putting on her. But when you're in love and you have a partner, then you share things. So it's going to happen. Plus, yeah. People who want to take advantage of you, you know, it's not hard for them to take advantage of you. Because most people aren't walking around constantly trying to protect themselves from being taken advantage of. Someone cheats on you, or someone lies to you, someone tricks you. You know, even the smartest, most well-bounded people on the planet can still be taken advantage of.
Oh, yeah.
So could gullibility be a factor? Maybe.
Maybe.
But you don't know that. The main factor is some asshole did an asshole thing.
Yeah.
So let's just focus on that. And it sucks. And yes, anonymous patron, I think that the worldview of safety is one of the factors.
Yeah.
That if you feel unsafe in the world and you are given data that the world is unsafe, bad things happen to another person, then it's natural for all of us to wonder, could it happen to me?
Right.
And if we have an easy, quick cognitive trick to play on ourselves to make us feel safe, then we can return to homeostasis.
Right.
And a very easy thing to do is just to say, well, I'm smart. The other person is dumb.
Right.
They made the wrong choice. They must have made the wrong choice. I don't make wrong choices. It won't happen to me. So absolutely, that's one of the factors.
Mm-hmm.
Bob mentioned another one of just generally feeling responsible. It's particularly if it's something that happened close to you, like if your partner comes home and says that, you know, like if Stacy came home and said that someone broke into her car, I would feel responsible. It would be normal and maybe healthy for me to feel connected and not responsible, like it's all my fault, but that we are dependent on each other, me and my wife. And so at least the question, did I not do something, or did I do something that might have been a factor in that? If I'm not differentiated enough, I might overfocus on that and look for a way out of that responsibility, worry that I might be blamed and rejected, and thus look for any reason to blame my wife. Like, well, where were you driving? And, you know, did you keep a bag in the car? I think that those are all factors, mm-hmm. possibly. And yeah, it's annoying. It's also kind of a privilege thing, I think. If someone comes from privilege, they're less likely to be victimized. You know, men are less likely to be victimized.
Oh, interesting. In
a lot of ways.
Right.
And it can be tempting, or a part of privilege, to just assume, well, the reason why I haven't been victimized in this way is because I'm just better.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's something about me that gives me some ability that right. other people don't have. And, you know, women or people of color are weak or whatever, they've been told.
Privilege is like bad breath. It's hard to smell your own.
Going out with the email, I wouldn't mind the victim blaming so much. He is just a colleague, but he has a 2-year-old daughter. She will grow up listening to these reactions. Jim is undoubtedly a good father and a good person in general, but I can't let go of the thought that someday someone will overstep his daughter's boundaries. Unfortunately, chances are pretty high, right, that yeah. will happen to his daughter. Mm. So just chime in here. What do you think about that?
Well, it ain't your table. Maybe it'll happen. Maybe it won't. Maybe if that child is victimized by somebody at some point, Jim will have this shitty response. And, you know, yeah, what are you going to do? It's not your responsibility. And you also have just about zero power over it.
Yeah. Yeah. I praise you, anonymous patron, for the compassion. And it absolutely, if you see a pattern, his daughter will definitely experience the pattern.
Yeah.
And you talk about overstepping boundaries, like being assaulted somehow, but there's all sorts of things that'll happen that kids will run to their parents feeling victimized or harmed, transgressed upon. Someone at school or the playground bothers them somehow, or the other parent bothers them somehow, or I don't know. There's just a lot. I wouldn't be surprised if some parents experience their kid coming to them a dozen times every day with some sort of "I was wronged" message. You know, I was wronged by this or whatever.
Yeah.
And to have a knee-jerk reaction, a worldview that everyone is responsible for taking precautions before being victimized, you know, to avoid being victimized. And if one is victimized or wronged, then they just didn't take the proper precautions. That's a pretty awful message. Especially if that's the sole message that's right. given to someone.
Right.
And if you're born into that worldview, you know, you could walk away feeling pretty shitty about yourself.
Yeah. Jim does.
Right.
Well, probably.
Right. Exactly. But at the same time, as Bob is saying, you don't know, and two, it's not your place. But I don't know. I mean, so the next question, I think, kind of gets at this, which
sure.
would you confront a colleague about this pattern and the possible effects it may have on his daughter growing up? If so, how would you tell someone something like that? Thank you very much about your insights. Smiley face. End of email.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you wouldn't talk to your colleague.
I certainly wouldn't confront. Like, confronting is just, I mean, even the word, it just sounds like picking a fight.
Well, let's say it was me. What would you say to me? I would hope that you cared about me and my family enough to say something. What would you say?
Well, let's see. What would I say? I can be very heavy-handed, so I got to be mindful about such things because, as you know, I can be very heavy-handed.
I mean, that's not my first impression. I mean, can you be heavy-handed like anyone else? Yeah, but that wouldn't be my assumption.
Let's say, okay, so you're victim blaming.
And you've seen a pattern and you're worried about my kid.
Right, okay. Kind of blaming the victim there, aren't you? Huh, I wouldn't want to be in the receiving end of that.
Forays?
I'm spitballing
you're
here.
Spitballing.
I don't actually know if I would say any of these things.
Yeah.
golly, I wonder how that's going to affect your kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty short forays and might work. Yeah. For me, if I were to say something, and I might, and I have, I will say things the way that I tell clients, which is, look, I have no idea. It's just my distance point of view. I'm not in your shoes. I'm not there when you're hanging out with your kid. I've never even met your kid, but I just want to throw this out here. I know you love your daughter. I know you care. And so this would be a coworker, not a client.
Yeah.
And you know, if I was close enough to the individual, I for the record, I probably would never say anything, but if I were close enough and cared to, I would say something like, I don't know, but I've just observed that there are times when we'll review a story of someone being victimized somehow, mugged or harmed or financially taken advantage of, like, you know, Jennifer over there. And you seemingly, and I don't know, maybe it's just my bias, but you seemingly always have this perspective that if they had only done something differently, then they could have protected themselves from being harmed in that way, which, you know, isn't necessarily a bad thing, because, you know, being smart about things is good. But I worry sometimes that you might be given the impression that other people are to blame for having been harmed by another person, you know, because to me, if someone harms another person, it's really the harmful person's fault. And sometimes you take all the precautions and you still get harmed by people. Yeah. You know, that happens. Sometimes you're just driving down the street and someone T-bones you and you were doing everything right. Sometimes you fall in love and there was no real indication that someone was going to take advantage of you. And then they do, you know, that happens. It's happened to me. I'm guessing it's never happened to you. I don't know. God bless you. That's not happened to you, but, but it's happened to me. And maybe you would see, and I hesitate to even share those things with you because I worry that you're going to, not because you're a dick, but because you just have this worldview that if I had taken the proper precautions, I would have avoided that. And, you know, that would be hurtful to hear from you. And so I guess I'm speaking for myself, but I also, I worry about the people around you, your daughter included. I'm not saying you're a bad, you seem like a very good father. I really have no idea. And you could tell me that I'm a complete idiot and I'm talking out of my ass. And I would agree because I don't know, but I care about you and I just want to throw that out there.
Hey, Jim, if you find that harmful, blame yourself.
Yeah, you're behind me, and that's what you say?
No, God, no.
YouTube member Natalia says, "Hi, Bob. Hi, Kirk. Long-time listener, first-time query submitter.
Oh.
Whenever I listen to your podcast, I'm always appreciative of how kind and patient you both seem as therapists and people. So here's my question. For the past year, I've been pretty torn about whether or not I want to have children. Mm. I'm married to a great man. It's our second year of marriage. He's a good husband. He's kind, patient, caring, and in my opinion, very manly. He's also an amazing dog dad to our little wild blue heeler. Do you know what a blue heeler is?
No.
I didn't either.
Yeah.
My brother got a blue heeler,
oh.
My little brother. It's the dog from Mad Max. Do you know the dog from Mad Max?
Oh, that's so long ago. Wait. Which one?
Well, can you see my screen?
Oh.
They kind of look like mutts to me.
Looks like a cattle dog.
But they, like in Mad Max with Mel Gibson.
So long ago.
Oh, I watched that movie every couple years.
I don't think I've ever really watched it.
It's a masterpiece, Mad Max. Yeah. Mm. Wait, the second movie is Road Warrior? Anyway, the second one. There was the first one.
Is it the first one was Road Warrior and the second one was Mad Max?
Oh, God damn it.
Oh, now we got to know.
Okay. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Road Warrior, right? The Road Warrior. Then there was Mad Max 3.
The Thunderdome one? Or whatever.
The one with
Tina Turner.
Tina Turner, yeah. We don't need another hero in Thunderdome. Anyway, Blue Heeler. And I always thought that dog was a mutt because It doesn't look like a purebred dog, and that dog is so smart in Mad Max. But I learned that they are very smart, and my brother has one, and it's a very hyper dog. Anyway.
A lot of energy.
But Natalia is saying that her husband, her manly husband, who's caring and patient and kind, is a very good dad dog to their blue heeler. Before we got together, I was pretty certain I'd never have children. I just wasn't interested at all. But after we started dating and got engaged, I've softened up to the idea. Now, I'm not very young. I'm 36. So biologically speaking, there's not that much time left for me to decide. How do I know that I'm making the right decision to not have kids? Will I regret not having children in the future? My husband says that he's okay with my decision, whatever it may be. But he comes from a difficult childhood, so he actually never wanted children either. But I've noticed in the last 2 years, he's also changed his mind. And now when I ask him, he says he wants to try for a child. Basically, I need some guidance on how to best make this decision in either direction. Many thanks. Bob, what do you think?
Well, ultimately, this boils down to just your own point of view. Anything anybody says is really just, you know, either a guess or some, in my case, here's what I would do is I would try it on mentally. This is my life. Just imagine what it'd be like to have a kid. And my old supervisor, David Taylor, used to say, put one thing in one hand and put one in the other and just imagine how it feels. So like close your eyes and imagine having a kid on in my left hand and then not having a kid in my right hand and just feel them. Just kind of feel what they feel like and see which one you're drawn to. Someone else might you might also do just a, like a pros and cons, a pros of having a kid versus a pros of not having a kid. And what's, you know, what do you imagine the differences in life are? What was the one? Oh, shit, it flew out of my head. Okay, well, anyways, the fourth one. Yeah, no, the fourth one, the fourth idea I have is what my brother says, which is there's something that happens to you when you have a kid, that you're a switch in your brain flips. And you fall in love with that child and then can no longer imagine a universe without. So I've never had one. I'm pretty clear that I don't want one and I have no regrets about not doing that. Though I do notice, you know, one is always aware of the road not taken, at least to some degree. Can't help but have that. And I mean, occasionally I'll wonder, you know, what would it have been like to have been a dad or to have had a child or whatever. And yeah. So I don't know. That's three ideas.
Yeah. I think just the only thing I'll add is that when it comes to huge life decisions like this, there might not be another huger life decision. Then it's helpful to talk about it, think about it, and explore it, and try it on for size, and just see how it feels. And it takes a long time, potentially. There's a lot of conversations, a lot of thinking, a lot of exploring, and you might find that you go up and down. Swing from one to the other. And that's just a part of the situation. The one asterisk I would say is that it's interesting that when people decide not to have kids or they think, because you can always have kids eventually, right? The decision not to have kids is deciding not to have kids in the near future, I suppose. But when people decide that they're not going to have kids in the near future or maybe ever, almost all the time people will say, I wonder if I'm going to regret it. When people decide to have kids, they almost never ask that question. I mean, I suppose some people do. And the reason is because our society is so fucked up about this still. And the other caution I would say is that I would be very careful about who you talk with about this. Because the average person will be shaming and pressuring and judgmental about your decision or just being on the fence, you know? Now, you might decide to have kids for sure if that's what you decide to do, if that's what you want. The other thing is that there's this notion out there that is false that for people, particularly women, who decide to have not to have kids, they have a high likelihood of regretting it later. And research does not show that. Might some people regret it? Yes.
Of course.
But the expected rate of regret is far, far lower than what a lot of people imagine.
Yeah, makes sense to me.
Let's take a break. When we get back, more emails or more of the questions from the survey. What do you say?
Right on.
All right, we're back from the break. Let's do an OPP, Bob. These people became patrons all the way back in 2021 and have stayed patrons ever since.
Right on.
We have Anna from Sweden, Elvira from Latvia, Whitney from Hawaii, Mari from Waterville, Washington, which I have never heard of before. Have you?
No.
Waterville, Washington. And the following people are from God knows where because they didn't leave a town. We have Raven, Ellen, Elizabeth, Stephanie, Frank, Fang, Phil, Catherine, Jules, Eyes of Mary, Kelsey, Roger, Joshua, Melissa, Janine, Dan, and Sophie, Dina, Susanna, Jeanette, Carolina, Michelle, Sienna, Sydney, Bree, Charlotte. A lot of these are actual city names in and of themselves. You got Charlotte. Sydney and Charlotte and Carolina.
Wow.
There's probably a Susanna somewhere, right? We have Laura, Esther, Ifra, Michael, Josie or Jose, depending, I suppose. Alejandro, Kyle, Dan, Michael, Vera, Kara, Lucy, and Yinka.
Thank you. That's a lot of patrons.
Yeah, well, it's just a lot of people who became a patron in 2021 who are a monthly deserving listener who did not list the city. So anyway, thank you so much for becoming a patron. Seriously, you pay most of my bills, patrons, and I would not be doing this episode if it weren't for you.
Kirk could not afford me.
And if you are not a patron, if you can become a patron, you can make me, as a self-employed worrier, a little less of a worrier. Anonymous patron says, what are the top five social constructs in place in the U.S. that you feel are the most damaging to your mental health, to our mental health?
Oh.
Things like white supremacy, individualism, beauty standards, gender discrimination, etc.
Yeah.
Bob, what do you think?
Well, those are some goodies. Homophobia, that's a big one. Racism, golly. The embedded hierarchy of privilege sucks. Let's see. What was the question? Social constructs?
Top five social constructs that are the most damaging to our mental health.
I'd say that there's a population of the culture that of Americans that have a sense of entitlement, and I kind of wish we would wake up from that. We're not owed anything. So we have a, I think that as a result of that, we shift responsibility for welfare and well-being onto others. I'm not saying everybody, and let's be clear that the people that I think are entitled are probably not the people that other people would say are entitled. So I'm not thinking about, you know, poor folks who are reliant on the public system. I'm not thinking about them. Actually, I'm thinking about, white men at the top of the hierarchy. We are not entitled to anything, and privileges of invisible... here's one for you. Privilege is invisible blinders. Can't see them, but they sure do blind you.
Hmm.
Yeah. We're not owed anything. So I wish we weren't. I wish there was a wake up.
How does that harm our mental health?
Well, I think it erodes personal growth. Kind of hard to grow if you don't think that there's something to grow from. I don't believe in, you know, chest beating, ego, worshiping. I don't believe in any of that. I believe in humility and kindness. I think that privilege will rob a person of that. So I don't know about mental health, but then again, those things I think are, I wouldn't say that they're disorders. They're certainly not mental illness. But they're impediments to a good life, making a good life. Mm. So I don't know if that qualifies as, you know, impediment to mental health, but welfare and well-being, overall development, yeah, for sure.
Mm. It's hard to measure these things, of course.
Yeah.
You know, what do we even categorize as a social construct in this category? How do we measure the amount of damage that occurs. And of course, for us to answer this, we're just coming from our own cultural vantage point. But for me, I think capitalism trumps everything else,
yeah.
Pun intended. So I want to be clear, I would rather live in my country that is oriented towards capitalism than a lot of other countries,
yeah.
Because it's not like capitalism doesn't have its positives. You know, there's no system of government or society that, in my experience, has completely won the day.
Yeah.
You know, I wish that my society was organized more towards socialism, more towards a safety net, more towards, you know, universal basic income, that kind of thing. But anyway, my point is that I think capitalism, although has its benefits, unregulated capitalism, unchecked capitalism, as we have in our society today and increasingly around the world, is responsible for, in my opinion, the most damage to the environment, the most damage to how we treat others. It mm-hmm. plays a role in white supremacy. It plays a role in homophobia. It plays a role in beauty standards and individualism. And it also plays a role in mental health, in that people consider themselves to be machines and consider themselves to be just a matter of productivity to the point of denying all their needs for human interaction, for love, for sex, for affection, for creativity, for leisure, spending time with your kids, just going on a walk, just staring at a sunset. Everything has to be monetized, and it's getting worse with Instagram and all those other things. Everything is commodified, and I'm not the first person to say this, and half of the stoners in college are saying this sort of shit, but I believe it. And I play into it. That if I wasn't indoctrinated into a capitalistic way of thinking, my life would look different than it does right now. I would wake up in the morning. That's an interesting question. I would work a lot less.
Yeah.
I would spend a lot more time cuddling with my friends and family. I'd probably only work like 10% what I work right now. I would not worry about the future and finances so much. Mm. I would scale back spending. I would only have one car in our family, and it would be a piece of shit. I would stop buying Christmas decorations, but I've been indoctrinated, and I worship at the altar of capitalism, materialism, and money and status, and I can't. It's hard. I think about it and I try to change, but it damages me, damages my well-being, my sleep, my health, my time. My anxiety, I suppose, my attachment security, my marriage, probably, my relationships. It damages all the things. And I spent a lot of time thinking about this shit. You can find a lot of people in Seattle who are actively working against white supremacy, racism, gender discrimination, homophobia, they will be very able to fight against that in their minds and in their world. They might make TikToks about it. They might march about it. And yet they will probably still be fully indoctrinated into a capitalistic way of thinking. It's so infused in how we think about things, what we value, what we think is good in life, the things that we praise, the things that we will be disgusted by. When people see someone in tattered, dirty clothes with a bad haircut, even the most aware person will be disgusted by that person, because capitalism has told us. The very fact that we think BO smells bad is because capitalists told us that BO smells bad. I will have arguments with people about this. I'll say, the fact that you think BO smells bad is not because it smells bad. It's because marketers have told you it smells bad, and now you believe it smells bad. And they'll be like, no, it smells this. Are you kidding me? BO is disgusting. And I'm like, yes, and empirically, it is disgusting to you. It's disgusting to me too. I do a lot of things to avoid smelling. And I also, if I smell someone's BO even slightly, I'm repulsed. Like I can't stand it. And it's because marketers have changed us, because they make money. When they create a problem, that didn't exist and sell us a product to solve that problem, they make money. And they've been experimenting on us socially, psychologically for decades. There are other societies where they don't notice it, or at the very least, the average amount of BO, right? They don't even, they're habituated to it, or they're just like, oh yeah, you know, that's life. People smell. And it's also infused in this elitism, you know, poor people smell, homeless people smell, foreigners, dirty foreigners smell with their disgusting foods and their, you know, stinky BO and bad hygiene. You know, it's all in there. And you will find the most liberal, kind, anti-racist, anti, you know, gender discrimination, you know, the most socially just individual, and they will still often adamantly hold that BO and tattered clothes, they might not say it, but they believe it, including myself. They've gotten under our skin. How many people feel ashamed of themselves for a variety of things that they are because marketers have told us that there's a thing you can buy to solve that problem.
Right.
There's this medication that you can take to reduce your cravings for food. There's this workout program. There's this diet book that you can buy. There's this class of Weight Watchers that you can take. There's this dress you can wear that will make you look slimmer. There's this Spanx thing. There's this filter on this app that will make your skin look pristine and young. It's constant, and it's just getting worse. And we wonder why people are anxious and depressed, and suicidality is on the rise, and people are lonely and disconnected. And, you know, I would, can you imagine someone in our society not having an ounce of hatred about the way that they look?
No, we're good at that.
I think literally every human being in the United States hates the way that they look. Like, not just like, I wish I could. I bet you every, maybe there's a, you know, a 0.001% of people who aren't like this, but I imagine everyone has a pretty sizable dose of self-hatred about their bodies, their face, their hair, their weight, the way they walk, the way they, there's some, you know,
teeth.
Do you think we were always like that? Do you think that a 1,000 years ago, or 100 years ago, do you think that humans were like that? And we've done studies like this. We look at small groups of humans who live today and do research with them, ask them questions about this sort of thing, and we find that it's not an inherent human quality. It's marketers, because you are disgusting, but I have the answer. You are disgusting. You are old, you're fat, you're ugly, your skin is wrong, your hair is wrong, your body hair is wrong, your odor is wrong, your teeth are wrong. They're not, you know, wide enough, your teeth. You have, you know, hairs coming out of your nose. Your shoes are goofy. You're out of fashion. You're frumpy. You're dirty. You're disgusting as a human. But I have an answer. And if you give me your credit card, then it's infused in our bones now. There are children that believe they're disgusting. And that's everybody, all of us, particularly people of color, particularly people that are being oppressed, right? But everybody, even the oppressor, wakes up in the morning and looks at themselves in the mirror and says they're disgusting. And that's just one aspect of life. So, yeah, I think capitalism is a scourge. An anonymous patron says, I'm really interested in the lack of a sense of self thing. I'm really interested in the lack of a sense of self thing because I experienced this. Isn't it rather the lack of what would commonly be interpreted as self-interest, and your self is just overly occupied with the wish to please others? Isn't it, so they're just saying, isn't the sense of self thing just what people call self-interest and also being overly occupied with trying to please others? Bob, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd say that that encapsulates quite a bit of what it is to what not having a sense of self is. Yeah, I'm with them.
Yeah. Well, at its foundation, a sense of self is feeling your emotions and your needs, knowing your needs. And that's a complicated topic, but that's the way I would put it.
Yeah.
From that comes a balance between self-interest and other interests.
Right.
From that comes a desire to want to please others, but also a knowing of yourself, valuing of yourself,
right,
and pleasing yourself. A lot of things stem from that basis of a sense of self. And in the literature, there's a lot of different definitions and really working models of what this sense of self. That's why I have changed it in my language to a connection with the self. Because to lack a self is nonsensical. Of course, you have a self.
Right.
You are a self. You just aren't in connection with it, you know? Anonymous patron says, me and my partner both came into our relationship with significant relational traumas. Me and my partner both came into our relationship with significant relational traumas. We are always learning about ourselves and one another to enhance our closeness and our ability to not mistreat the other through trauma reactivity when one of us is triggered. Because we both struggle with mental health and trauma reactivity, and we have created relational traumas within our relationship too. Wait, what? Oh, that was a full sentence. Anyway, sadly, there are things we have done to each other that constitute abuse and have caused trauma to the other person. How do we manage the relational traumas that we have put upon each other? Bob, what do you think?
Say you're sorry. Commit to not doing it again. And listen to the story of the harm that you caused, and be willing to speak plainly as you can about the harm your partner caused, and have them say they were sorry. Hmm. And maybe it comes around again. I don't know. Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. But maybe it does. Maybe I could apologize for something I did, and then somehow, you know, 8 months from now, where something triggers it, my partner, and they're upset about it again. It seems to me that it's only reasonable to be sensitive to that which is unfolding. And if my partner's having trigger, it doesn't matter whether I apologized last time. And it certainly doesn't mean that that apology was worthless. It just means that we have another round of it and another opportunity to make it safe. So actually, if you could just treat those things as opportunities to help your partner feel safe, you're probably ahead of the game.
Mm-hmm. Is that what you do?
Yes. More and more these days.
What?
I am, is that what I do? Hold on a sec. Is that what I do? Do I do that? I have to say, I'm falling in love with apologies, like real ones, no bullshit, real ones, and recognizing where my behavior has impacted my partner. Now, did I talk about the solar panels?
No.
We just had them installed last
week.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah, they're awesome. Well, we've talked about it, yeah. But you haven't talked about it on the podcast.
Well, what happened was...
do you mix up your conversations with me off with the conversations on microphone?
I can't remember anything I said to anybody, so yeah, I do. So I've been wanting to get solar panels for a long time, and I started talking to installers, and so somebody came to my house.
Did when I got them a year ago. Did it spark your interest even more?
Yeah, but it also, you know, I was aware of what it cost you, and I was thinking, well, you know, that's out of reach.
Yeah.
But I just started thinking about it and whatever, and talking to somebody about it who happened to come to my house. I see, how did I get? I don't remember. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it costs a shit ton of money. Yeah. I mean, in my head, I thought, yeah, you know, it'll cost X amount. And when I had some quotes given, especially the first quote I got, I was just like, holy
right.
Jiminy crickets.
Yeah.
But then I thought, well, I do want to be better to the environment.
Right. But I don't remember, but a couple months ago, I started looking into it more seriously, and an installer came to my house one Saturday and went through a quote with me. And I was looking at it, I was like, well, that's some dough. But I could see a way that we might be able to do that. And when Colleen got home that evening, I went through it with her, and she got upset with me because the bottom line was, you know, it's a lot of dough. And we got in a fight about it. And I was sort of righteous, like, because I didn't attack her, I didn't deserve her upset about the price of the thing. And that's utter and fucking complete bullshit. So the next day she found me in the house, and she said she was sorry and that she didn't think that solar panels were a waste of money and that she knew I were interested in it and we could talk about it. And I was like, that's right. You're the jerk and I'm not. Blah, blah, blah. Right. And then the next day, I thought about it some more and I said to her, no, babe, I'm sorry. Because I talked to you in a way that was insensitive.
The originally?
Yeah. And I didn't attack her. That's true. But money's a sensitive subject. And I treated it like, hey, you want to have pot roast for dinner? And let's drop 44 grand on solar panels, which is not what it cost, but that's what the quote was. And I apologized to her for that. And since then, what I notice is that when we talk about money, this isn't news. I mean, we've been together 18 years. But when we talk about money, what I'm practicing is a sensitivity to that because it is a touchy subject. And let's face it, ain't nobody all that sane. We're all non-rational beings running around. It's a wonder we didn't kill each other. But expecting that my partner is going to be sane or have the responses that I believe are reasonable is just silliness. It's just silliness. And vice versa, for her to expect me to have, you know, not have my raw spots or whatever is just crazy. It's crazy to think that we're not crazy. So when we talk about things that are related to money, I'm just more observant and watchful and hopefully, I think I am actually succeeding in being sensitive to where she is and not where I think she should be. And I'm just sort of applying that in general across the board. It's like, stop trying to get Colleen to be what you think a person is supposed to be and just pay attention to her where she is. And that works better. It's actually practical because my life goes better if I don't try to buck reality. My life goes better. In fact, the only reason we have solar panels is because I said to her, I'm sorry.
You say my life goes better because in the moment it feels like it's the opposite. It feels like you're giving in and you're diminishing your life.
It does feel that way. And I'm fighting that more and more. Successfully, though, and that's a biggie.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I've been doing that, and for, I don't know, maybe the last 2-3 months, I've been doing that more conscientiously. And I often am thinking about you when I do it. I'm like, yeah, Kirk said this to me years ago.
I did?
Yeah.
What did I say?
Well, you didn't say, Bob, da 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 da. You just say, like, well, that's the way it is. Talking about your partner, that's the way it is. Well, that's the way they are. Which is true. It is. And
I was saying that you just have to accept the way your partner is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, good practice.
Within a reason, of course. If your partner's abusive, then you don't have to accept that.
Yeah. No, Colleen, but Colleen isn't. And so, yeah. But, right. Yeah. So.
Right. Yeah. I try to adhere in my marriage to the philosophy that, yeah, I guess in my mind, I would like to tweak some things about her personality. But I wonder if it would be worse. I don't know. At the very least, I can't. And so I have to accept that she is that way.
Right.
She has those patterns or tendencies or repetitive quirks, at least in my mind, are quirks. Maybe they're normal things to everyone else. I don't know. And this rigidity around like, but that is wrong. That needs to change. That's not functional. Is not functional.
No. It isn't. It isn't.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like that scene in The Matrix, right? Where Neo's sitting with that little boy and the boy's bending spoons with his mind. And he says to Neo, don't try to bend the spoon. That's impossible. Instead, only try to see the truth. And Neo goes, what truth? And the kid says, there is no spoon. And then you'll see that it is only yourself that bends, which is true. And what I notice is I have blind spots, but I actually notice my blind spot. Like, oh, that's that point where I get a little righteous and I think she ought to be more da da da. Oh, yeah, what's that a cover for? And usually it's the same stuff. It's like a cover for, I'm afraid to speak to her about my want or my feel because I've been afraid to speak to anybody for my whole life. So yesterday we're having a happy hour, and she's talking about something, and I just thought, I don't know where you are, I don't know what this is, but I'm kind of, you know, restless and a little frustrated with it. And I realized, oh, I'm getting righteous. I can feel criticism bubble up inside me, and it wants a voice. And boy, we've gone down that road a number of times. Not like that does anybody any good. And I started thinking, oh, Bob, you want Colleen's attention, and you have no fucking idea how to get it, which is true. So I said to her, I'm feeling, I didn't say it exactly this way, but I'm feeling kind of frustrated because I really want your attention. And I don't even know how to get it. And I actually don't know what I want it for. Like, it's not like I want to tell you a story about X, but I noticed that I do. And I'm crap at trying to get it. And initially she's like thinking that that was some veiled criticism of her, that I was somehow coming. I'm like, no, babe, I'm crap. I'm crap at getting attention. And I'm also sorry, because it's not your fault. And my restlessness or whatever, it isn't your fault either. And I just don't know how to do it. I actually don't. But that's a blind spot. And I have zipped past that countless times and, you know, think and been righteous about it. And I've been thinking about my mom. My mom has Alzheimer's, and, you know, she's 84, and she's coming to the jumping off place. And I think the Alzheimer's, it's the final robbery. But the thing is she was never able to seek the thing that she wanted or needed. And I think that made her behave in some really jerky ways, and still does. I mean, the Alzheimer's is not a free pass for some of the abusive, verbally abusive stuff that she does with my sibs, that she doesn't do with me because I live 3,000 miles away. Anyways, but she was never any good at it, and my dad neither, and I think about them coming up and not having a shot at what might have been a more peaceful or joyous existence. And, you know, I wish that had been gone better for me, because, you know, I grew up in, you know, that their legacy of, you know, they inherited a legacy of their own blind spots and their own inabilities and troubles with their moods and troubles with their own existence and believing in themselves. I mean, my dad.
Yeah, a lot of self-hatred, likely.
Yeah.
Because right, exactly. They were treated in a really horrible way.
Horrible way. And so they passed the legacy on. And sometimes I think, golly, I don't know what grace got shined on me, but I'm a lot better off than she ever was. Mm-hmm. And I still, I mean, I'm frustrated with the struggle that is in me pretty much all the time. But I know it more than I used to, and I know it a hell of a lot more than she ever had a shot at learning, or my father either ever had a shot at learning. And as a result, I can conduct myself in my marriage in a way that is kinder, more realistic, gentler. Those are all the same thing, in my opinion. So I'm glad for that. And this is a little bit of a departure from where we started, which was something about how does the person help with the relational, you know, crap that she and her partner, or he and her partner and their partner, toss on one another. And I don't know, that's a long answer and my version of how that helped. Mm-hmm. But doing it put solar panels on my roof. Hmm. So that's kind of nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. And the only thing I'll say is I'd rather be in a relationship that had these abuses to each other and deep apologies.
Yeah.
Than in a relationship that had no apologies and was on the surface, everything is fine.
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't like the abuse when it happened.
No.
It would feel bad, but the genuineness and the love and the connection and the repair and the closeness and the vulnerability of a good apology. Yeah, that's everything.
Yeah, agreed. And this person got a nice shot at that with their partner.
Yeah.
Because there's this lovely awareness.
Right. So you don't have control over your traumas and your healing regarding that. I mean, you have some control over the rapidness of it, the speed of the recovery. But, you know, typically it takes years and years of good therapy and corrective experiences. You don't have control over that. But you do have control over what Bob's talking about, which is to be genuine and real and vulnerable and apologetic.
Yeah.
That is attainable, especially by the two of you probably, because it sounds like you're aware of what's happening.
Right.
It's a struggle. It's not easy.
Nope.
But the closeness and the love and the repair and the goodwill, the bond that can happen between people when they both mutually participate in that is some of the strongest bonds you'll ever experience.
Yeah, nicely put.
All right, let's take a break. We get back. Maybe one more question. What do you say?
Right on.
All right, we're back from the break. Let's just do a short OPP.
Yeah.
These people became patrons in 2021 and have stayed patrons ever since. These are monthly more deserving listeners, so middle tier patrons. Mm-hmm. Sarinda from Australia, Jessica from Brooklyn, New York, Miss Jess from Clovis, California, Ashlyn from Colton, California, Beth from Dover, Pennsylvania, Hannah from Eugene, Oregon, sorry about the ducks, Jacqueline from Harriman, Utah, Benazir from Modesto, California, Morgan from Nanaimo, British Columbia, just north of us, Matt from Seattle, which is where we're at right now, Katarina from Vaughan, Ontario, and Scribe from God knows where. Thank you for becoming a patron almost 3 years ago and staying a patron all of this time. Last question, Patron Jack says, I'm trying to get into therapy, but my biggest obstacle is my suspicions on how good my therapist actually is. I'm trying to get into therapy, so I'm trying to like invest in therapy, I think. Mm-hmm. But my biggest obstacle is my suspicions on how good my therapist is. It seems every time I see a new therapist, It seems every time I see a new therapist, I wonder if what they are doing or saying is actually the best thing for me. I guess I'm spoiled by you and Dr. Honda, since I wonder how they would be handling this situation. How can I overcome this obstacle of avoiding therapy over fear of it not being good enough? Further, how can I know what method of therapy is best for me? CBT, schema, given my anxiety and brain fog. Bob, what do you think?
I wouldn't be able to say what kind of therapy is best for you, though my own bias is attachment oriented. And let's be clear that if you hired me to be your therapist, these questions would come into our session. So you might feel trusting of Kirk or me, you know, but you don't have a relationship with us, and we are not, we do not constitute any kind of, we ain't going to trigger whatever it is that makes you question. Sounds like you're really insecure and you're trying to keep yourself safe. And I'm just going to say what I always say, which is you should talk about that with the therapist. I don't know how to guide you with what kind of therapist to see. Though based on what you said, I would search for somebody who has an attachment orientation. So find somebody that's like Kirk or me, who does stuff like we do. I don't know how to do that. I don't know what to say to you, but I think that's probably in the long run. And be willing, because you're not going to like it. Talk about when you feel like the therapist doesn't know what they're doing, mm-hmm. right? I get haughty, or I have gotten haughty towards my therapist because he's younger than me. What a jerk face. My willingness to talk about that has been healing, as opposed to, you know.
How do you bring it up?
Oh, I say, I have haughty feelings towards you.
Well, how'd you bring it up the first time?
I said, I have a haughty feeling towards you because you're 43. You're younger than me, and I'm supposed to be taking advice from you. I don't really want to do that, you know, and I don't like that I feel this way. And he responded with acceptance and an easy manner about it. I think my therapist is a pretty tough guy and believes in himself, and so that didn't knock the cheese off the cracker for him. He was okay with it. If you had a therapist and they had a kind of a personal response to that sort of thing, they're just mismanaging their feelings, and either their own stuff is bleeding over or there's some kind of countertransferential thing, who knows, but it would just mean that they have something to work on. I don't know that that necessarily constitutes a reason to fire somebody. It depends on whether or not they actually did work with it.
Yeah. I don't know what more to say. To answer your last question, best method of therapy, given your anxiety and brain fog, I find that people use the word anxiety for a lot of different things. If you're talking about a phobia, then exposure and cognitive therapy is really the only thing to do.
Right.
But people use anxiety for pretty much any distress psychologically, I find.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is sometimes the way experts in the literature will use it as mm-hmm. well. There's yeah. a lot of different definitions of it. So it really just depends. What are you afraid of, I guess, is the question. And in what way are you afraid? Because mm-hmm. if you're afraid of closeness and you experience like panic, then that's one thing. If you're afraid of closeness because you just notice that you avoid it, or you will be uncomfortable and irritable or upsetting to other people some way, and you frame that as anxiety, that's a whole other thing. When you talk about brain fog, my goodness, Jack, that I've worked with clients on that, and I have looked into a lot of the research. There are a lot of different paths to what people would call brain fog. There's a lot of different kinds of brain fog. It's essentially a field that's similar to fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue or IBS. The science is hard to conduct because the symptoms are harder to define and lock down to measure. You're basing it on someone's report and they're the kind of symptoms that a lot of people experience, like fatigue or inability to concentrate or headaches or feeling just kind of subdued in one's brain, like your brain just isn't working quite right. There's a lot of different experiences. There's dissociation, there's anxiety, there's distress, there's lack of sleep, there's ADHD, there's other neurodivergence, there's there was one big one that I didn't, there's another big, did I say depression?
No, you did not.
Okay. There's depression as well. There's a lot of different roads to brain fog, and there's probably a lot of roads that we don't even have names for. Also, long COVID or really any virus can cause brain fog long-term, research shows. Again, it depends on what we mean by brain fog. But psychotherapy is not likely to work unless it's related to something like depression or anxiety or ADHD or something. But there's a lot of seemingly unknown paths and also biological paths that psychotherapy, as far as the mechanism of psychotherapy, wouldn't necessarily help. The clinician might be able to advise you about things to do, like sleep hygiene or diet or stress level or things that aren't really in the realm necessarily of psychotherapy and more in the realm of what we call psychoeducation or referral to a specialist or something. But that one's hard. But with anxiety, it really just depends on what you mean by that. But yeah, in addition to what Bob said about talking with a therapist, it's also possible, Jack, that you have a defense, and I think Bob was kind of getting at this, that kicks in when you get close and threatened by that closeness, threatened by rejection, threatened by criticism or scrutiny by a therapist. I've had a lot of clients like this, and it's hard, and they consciously will be thinking a lot about the therapist's intelligence. And, whenever I get a client that says this, where they sit down and they say, I sought you out because I think you're smart or something like that. And, you know, it's not necessarily a slam dunk indication of that, but they'll say, my previous therapists were not smart. They couldn't keep up with me or something like that. It usually is the tip of the iceberg regarding a defensive structure in one's personality that can be kind of pervasive, that is a defense overall of superiority and intelligence and distancing and feeling neglected. You know, the corrective experience for these folks is to have them be vulnerable and dependent for a time, and I am safe and caring and non-rejecting. And the way that these folks will avoid that is to preemptively reject everyone. And, you know, one of the methods that humans are, one of the methods that's available to humans to develop when they're quite young is to think of themselves as being superior in some way. And one of the ways that manifests is to think that you're smarter than everybody. It doesn't take intelligence to be vulnerable, and it doesn't take intelligence for a therapist to be a safe recipient of that vulnerability. You don't have to be smart. You have to understand how to love a client, and you have to know attunement, and you have to build a relationship. You have to be probably a good therapist, but you don't have to have a high, you don't have to have a high IQ for that. So now you, Jack, mentioned nothing about intelligence. I just want to say that. You were just saying, I wonder if, you know, another possibility, Jack, is that you've had a bad string of bad fits, which is, I think, very common. If I just use myself as an example, I've lived in Seattle my whole life. I know a lot of therapists. I know how to shop for therapists. So my rate of finding a bad fit, you would think, would be pretty low. And yet, I would say half to a third of the therapists that I have actually tried out in person for a number of sessions were not only not good fits for me, but were worthless fits to me. I mean, I'm sure they were fine therapists, but it was just completely not working with these people, you know? And of the therapists that quote unquote worked for me, there were some that worked a lot more than others in different ways. So it's possible, Jack, that you've just had, you know, even if you've had five therapists and none of them were really kind of in that sweet zone, it's possible that you just haven't found the right one. You know, it can take a while. And for everyone out there, if you have one of those therapists like Bob does where it fits and it's in that sweet zone, as I weirdly put it earlier, then don't let go of them because they're hard to find, you know? It's perhaps harder than finding your soulmate in some ways, you know? It's just as important. It's really hard. So there's that. And if you have a good fit, you know, say something nice to your therapist along those lines, because your therapist, if they are a good fit, they're probably putting a lot of effort into, you know, not changing their personality, but evoking a vibe in the session to make it a good fit for you. So, you know, spread the love a little bit. And along those lines, everyone out there, please take care of yourself, love yourself, because
you deserve it.